Radiotopia.
I'm excited to tell you that one of our favorite Radiotopia siblings, Ear Hustle, is back with a new season. Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast. Co-hosts Nigel Poor and Erlon Woods have recently been spending time at four California prisons and have a season's worth of funny, surprising, and unforgettable stories to share. In a recent episode, they were able to visit a groundbreaking prison hospice where they spoke to men who are grappling with the reality of dying inside prison. Also coming up this season are stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells, complicated mom-daughter relationships in prison, and incarcerated people who wonder whether they've become too comfortable behind bars. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it. Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Dear Diary.
Sixth grade.
February 14th.
1991.
I am really depressed.
How could she break up with me?
Mom, you can't read this.
So essentially, you know how you have like certain stories that you tell a lot? Are they in your repertoire?
Some of them, yes.
That's one of our producers, Hadley Dion, in the car with her father, Hal. We asked her to do the unthinkable. Ask her dad to tell a joke she's heard countless times while trapped in the worst place imaginable, a family road trip.
Samantha was a very sweet woman, and it was a very, very sad time when I found out that her husband had passed away. And so obviously we all attended the funeral, and one of his daughters got up to speak. And she spoke about how wonderful her father was. And she said, you know, he was just the light of my life. And he had a wonderful outlook on life. And one day I came home from school and I was like, Dad, you know, it's just not right. Things are just not fair. And he said, fair? You want fair? Oh, they have one in Pomona once a year.
Oh my God.
What is it about a dad that makes him want to tell the same joke over and over again? It's like they hear a joke once and they bank it, and then they pull it out whenever their kids least want to hear it.
There was a great dad joke. It's not mine. This was from Groucho Marx. He says, outside of a dog, a book is man's best friend. Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read.
This is Norman. A man who believes that the secret to a great dad joke is the one-sided joy felt only by the teller of the joke.
Normally what I do, I'll deliver the joke, I'll wait a second, people will get the dumbest look on their face, and I'll wave my hand slowly over their head and say, permission to land denied.
And the worst part is, the more their sense of humor embarrasses their children, the more jokes they tell, and the more it starts to fray on their children's nerves.
My wife and I make up jokes all the time and just toss them out there. One time she was online and she says, so tell me, how does a Zen Buddhist order a hot dog? He says, make me one with everything.
From PRX and Radiotopia, this is the Mortified Podcast. I'm Neil. And in honor of Father's Day and all the dads that live to embarrass their children, we present tales of kids who love their dads, but also would love their dads to, like, totally change. Yes, it's our puntastic, prank-filled Father's Day tribute to dear old dad.
One year, I must have been 4 or 5, he convinced me to go up on Santa's lap and ask for an organ transplant for Christmas.
Growing up, Liza had a father who had his own cruel take on the dad joke.
Because he just wanted to see Santa fall apart at that request. All day long, you know, you're getting, I want a pony, I want a beach ball or whatever kids ask for. What do you say to a child that walks up and gets on your lap and says she wants a new kidney? Santa didn't get emotional. Santa just tried to remain composed and say, let's hope that turns out for you.
And having a dad like that can be loads of fun. Well, until you become a self-conscious teenager.
In the suburbs outside of Jackson, Mississippi, life with my dad wasn't always easy. He was an outdoorsy man's man who I secretly believed wanted a boy instead of two rambunctious little girls. And his desire for a son manifested itself in adolescent pranks and jokes and behavior that little boys would find hilarious, but little girls found repulsive. And the hardest part was you never knew when you were going to be the target of one of his shenanigans. So I spent the ages from 14 to 16 documenting my frustrations and general angst in an online public forum called LiveJournal. Yeah. So sometimes I use my LiveJournal to document the ridiculousness in the form of one-act plays. February 5th, 2005, 12:07 a.m. Fade in. Scene. Living room of the family household. Mother and Liza are watching television. Father enters stage right. Father, Liza. You're never going to guess what I just found out. I did not know this before today. Liza, what? Father, rats have 10 nipples. Fade to black. September 7th, 2005, 4:11 a.m. A word of advice. Don't ever let my dad fix you a hot dog because he'll put doggy treats in it when you aren't looking and then cackle when you bite down on it and then eat the whole thing because you thought it was just a really crunchy onion. So that's my dad's sense of humor. It's hilarious and educational and sometimes really random. So we had that going on.
My sister was having, I want to say, her 12th birthday party and had 20 other girls over to our house. And then they were doing the Candyman, Candyman, Candyman in the mirror in the bathroom.
And I'm sitting there thinking, okay, they've just set me up for a joke. This is Norman. I'm Liza's dad. And I have known her most of her life. No, all of her life.
And so my dad crawled into the attic of the house, got into the air vents above the bathroom, waited for all of these little girls to say Candyman in the mirror, and then just like growled, like,
get out now
into the air vent.
And there was a vibration in the house. It's like an earthquake right underneath my feet of these girls screaming and shaking and vibrating.
And they were just running through the house, just screaming their heads off.
I put everything back, laughing to myself, and climbed back out. And I go walking outside. They had that shaken, panicked look on their face. It's real. It's real.
He was so proud.
March 28th, 1:46 p.m. Mood, sick. Oh my God. I totally just threw up my Dr. Pepper float. I was eating it, and I looked down at the ice cream, and I saw something kind of long and thin, and I thought it was maybe a stray vanilla bean, but upon closer inspection, it was a bug. Ah! One of those massive, scary crane flies in my float. I just saw it, and I flipped the fuck out. Oh my God. My dad kept going, I bet it was a female, and I bet it laid eggs in your float. March 31st, 8:42 p.m., mood, embarrassed. Daddy is telling a story about the time he got drunk off moonshine. Poor Daddy. At least he isn't singing Busta Rhymes anymore. January 31st, 1:36 p.m., mood, jealous. Okay, what the fuck? My dad is pissing me off so much right now. He got me this gerbil about a week ago, and he clearly stated that it was mine, like not his to touch, not his to name, not his to do anything with. And what does he do? Busts into my room at the crack of why is he awake, turns on my light, leaves my door open so I have to listen to the blaring TV in the living room, walks over all of my things, and starts fucking talking to my gerbil. And now, he takes him out of his cage like every fucking day and plays with him. And I gave him a name, finally. Spinner. I like it. It's simple and pet-like. And my dad's like, no, let's name him Elvis or Buddy. What the fucking hell? No. I'll call him what I want to because it's my fucking gerbil. Ugh. I mean, really, I want my gerbil to like me and consider me its mama, but no. My fucking father has to bust up in there and take him out every day and play with them, so now my gerbil doesn't even like me anymore. Fuck, I hate this. I wish I'd never even gotten this gerbil because my gerbil hates me. He bites me, makes me gush blood, and he won't even let me hold him or anything. And then my dad goes in there, and my gerbil is calm as a fucking Hindu cow and just lets him... and just lets him handle him all he wants, and I want to tell my dad that he can have it because there's no point in me having anything to do with this gerbil because he hates me and loves my dad. So, remember how this was a public journal? I got a couple of comments telling me that I was being selfish or whatnot. But then I got this one. So I'll read this for you. Anonymous, from Anonymous. He's yours. Let your dad know that he's yours and leave him alone. Don't to watch him. Like, make him a sandwich or something to eat, and just before he eats it, take it back. See how he likes that. Tell your dad if he wants one, go get his own. So it turns out the person who left this comment, complete with trying to be teenager misspellings, was my dad.
So, Dad, you did comment on my live journal. You commented anonymously, but you made it sound like it was a teenager. So you had a lot of, like, misspellings, and you specifically told me to make my dad a sandwich, and then whenever you're about to eat it, to take it away and see how you like it. You told me to do that.
That was beautiful. Like, that sounds like something I'd do.
I call that parenting through playful trauma.
She didn't die from it.
I think one theme of a lot of my dad's pranks and hijinks was that they weren't meant to be harmful. Like, he was never going to hurt you or do any lasting psychological damage.
When you put a rat in a maze, he reasons his way all the way through it. You put him in that maze again, and they take a beeline to the exit or the cheese on the end. And Liza's done that. She doesn't waste time on looking around corners and going back over here. She knows exactly where to go. And to me, that's part of creative parenting. And my wife and I have tried to make them think. And sometimes that's exactly what they don't want to do.
Not taking myself too seriously was probably the best thing my dad ever taught me in terms of surviving adolescence, surviving high school, college. And now I'd like to think that I'm a pretty well-adjusted adult.
That was Liza Sisson at the Amsterdam in the Twin Cities. And coming up, our girl takes a creative approach to getting some fatherly attention. But first, this message from our friends at Quip. The truth is, it's not just kids, but us adults who still brush our teeth the wrong way. Maybe we're not brushing long enough, and because we're so busy, we forget to change out our brush often enough. And that's because most brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing. But not Quip. Quip's electric brushes come with a handy built-in timer that provides guiding pulses to remind you when to switch sides. And even better, Quip is more affordable than other bulkier electric brushes on the market. With their subscription plans, you'll get replacement brush heads delivered on a dentist-recommended schedule for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. Find out why everyone from Time to Oprah love Quip, and why Bloomberg calls it the Tesla of toothbrushes. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/mortified right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/mortified. That's getquip.com/mortified. While our first storyteller vented her frustration with her dad through an online diary, our next storyteller vented her frustrations by penning a literary masterpiece. Here's Elaine Casket on stage at the Leicester Square Theatre in London.
Hi, I'm Elaine.
Hi, Elaine.
Hello. growing up in Indiana, there wasn't a whole lot going on. My dad was a doctor, and he was frequently away with his busy medical practice. But at age 9, I conjured up a more attentive father figure in my very first novel, More Than a Neighbor. Tom Harris had nothing but time on his hands and a burning desire to hang out with all the neighborhood children. With the full blessing of their hands-off parents. Unfortunately, I was completely unaware of the creepy undertones to this surrogate dad. Snowballs flew briskly about the houses one wintry day. The door of the new neighbor's house opened, and the man who had moved in the day before came out. He looked very nice. The children liked him at once. "Call me Tom," said Tom. A few days later, he got lonely, so he began to make calls. The first house he went to was Susan and Jim's. He looked at the snow forts and sled for a long time. He sighed. Susan and Jim were upon him like two young bears. "Hello there," cried Tom. Come on, let's settle down and talk." The children obediently sat beside him. "Where are your mother and father?" "Let's not talk about them," Susan said quickly. "They got killed in a car crash." "Oh," said Tom, "I see." After tea and talk, Tom said goodbye and walked off whistling. Tom trudged up a snowy drive to Ethel's house. A girl opened the door, but neither one spoke. She stared. Tom stared. After about 15 minutes... Ethel was heard. "Oh, hello, Tom. Come in. You haven't met my sister before. This is Goldie." "I haven't seen you around the neighborhood," said Goldie slowly. "How old are you?" Tom answered, 26. "And you?" 21, answered Goldie, "but I'll be 22 next week." Tom felt very glad he had made a friend almost his age. Before they knew it, everyone was craving for lunch. Luckily, only two plates got broken, only one spoon got bent, three glasses got broken, and there were no spills. My dad didn't have as much time as I would have liked to arrange surprises for me or to take me on fun trips, but Tom did. Whenever he returned from an absence, the party was on. And as the children went to bed that night, they realized that Tom was much more than a neighbor. Spring came, and with it, warm weather. Tom called all the children's parents. He asked them if he could take the children somewhere. "Just send them over to my house at 10 a.m. Oh, and send their swimming suits with them." They were going to Lake Merlin. When they got there, they decided to swim first because you shouldn't swim until about an hour after eating. That's what you have to be careful with in this scenario. Tom proposed that each one show a trick they can do in the water. Tom won because everyone thought his trick was the best. Tom said to the children, "Come into my house. I've got a big surprise for you." The children eagerly followed. Tom called Buttons, and a little lap dog ran out. "Wait till you see her collar," Tom said, laughing like a boy. I belong to Tom Harris and his 12 best friends. "Oh, Tom, how can we ever thank you?" And the children ran over and kissed and hugged Tom, not at all ashamed to show all their love and affection for the man that was so like a father to them all.
I got questioned pretty thoroughly on whether this was based on any gentleman that might actually be in the neighborhood. I was like, no, I made it up. My parents were like, oh, okay, you could tell us. But I think there's probably an element to which I really would have liked to hang out a little bit more with my dad or have him be able to be a little bit more relaxed more of the time. So I think that Tom Harris was sort of a creation that was about that.
Well, I desperately wanted to be involved in my dad's work, but he didn't need a kid hanging around his medical practice, and he was too preoccupied for any of my business ideas. But luckily, Tom always had time. The next morning, he told the children that the surprise was ready. They jumped up and down and hugged and talked. Tom put up a sign saying, "The Museum of Underwater Life. Press knob for service." So everyone ran the Museum of Underwater Life together in Tom's converted shed out back. But just like I felt like I was losing my dad to his work, the children began to notice that Tom's attention was elsewhere too. On Saturday, Tom closed the museum at noon and he put a sign on the buzzer, "Museum of Underwater Life closed." Then he packed the children in his truck and drove to the pet shop. Patrick opened the door. "Gracious Harris, might these be all your lads and lassies?" "They are my friends. And this," Tom put his arm around Goldie, "is a very, very good friend. Ethel knew something was brewing. She noticed a new ring on Goldie's finger. Why, Goldie, that's a very pretty ring. Oh, this? I got it from a friend." Later that week, Ethel wanted to get a necklace, so she walked to Kevin's jewelry store. Suddenly, her eyes fell on a sign. "Engagement rings, $20 each, guaranteed to last forever, jewel in middle." She gasped. The engagement rings were just like the one that Goldie wore. If it wasn't a mistake, Tom might be far away with Goldie. It's like they have their own house. How miserable that would be. Well, ultimately, just like Tom got caught up in real life, but he was still there for the children. I knew my dad loved me. He was just busy. My dad knew that I could conjure up whatever I needed by writing about it. And I was so proud of More Than a Neighbor that I actually sold copies to all of my school friends. There are still some $2 copies available. This was the order form. You could get it in fancier cursive font on the front.
More Than a Neighbor, it was published in hardback and softback, self-published. My uncle had a printing company. My grandmother had taught me how to bind books in hardcover, and my mother typed it up for me. I remember being fairly assertive about approaching the school librarian about stocking a copy of it in the school library. I remember really wanting it to be available for circulation, and I remember being really chuffed that the school librarian was into it. I would check at the back of the book every once in a while to see whether it had been checked out, and people did check it out. I ended up going to journalism school. I am writing a nonfiction book about the unintended consequences of our data sticking around for maybe longer than we stick around. My deadline is soon, so I'm going to be turning it in soon. I know my dad's proud of my writing. I'm remembering now that he sent me a text when I got my book contract recently and said that he was really proud of me. And I know he has been all along, from More Than a Neighbor to this, and that makes me happy.
So looking back, I realized that Tom wasn't a surrogate father, but he did remind me of my dad's love. In the closing Christmas scene, it was very Norman Rockwell. Everyone was one big happy family. The children and their families flocked to Tom's house. It seemed the biggest pile of presents was at his feet. To the children, Tom and Goldie actually gave a puppy each. The children laughed and clapped their hands and hugged and danced around Tom and Goldie, and the parents were pleased that their children had made such a good friend. And even when the children were grown into adulthood, they never forgot Tom. The end.
That was Elaine Casket, recorded on stage in London. And today's story doesn't just end here. It continues with you. Grab something to write with for today's journal assignment.
Hooray!
What's the one story or joke your dad tells you every single time you see him? Does it drive you crazy? Do you love it? Ignore it? Happy journaling. As always, all the childhood writings were shared with no embellishing, no exaggerating, just God-given awkwardness. And this concludes our tribute to Dad, where we learned, if you're looking for a great Father's Day gift this year, consider giving him the gift of gerbils. But the question remains, should you let him name it?
No. I'll call him what I want to, because it's my fucking gerbil.
To share the shame, follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, or watch The Mortified Guide on Netflix, or visit getmortified.com to learn about upcoming Mortified live events, books, films, and beyond. Click participate, and who knows, you might even appear on a future episode of this podcast. As many of you know, The Mortified Podcast is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX. Thanks to AdCirc for providing their ad-serving platform to Radiotopia. And if your company would like to support our podcast, that would be great. Just email sponsor at radiotopia.fm. Our podcast production team for this episode includes Hadley Dion, Joey Fishcrown, Kylie Harrington, Dave Nadelberg, and myself, Neil Catcher. Marcus Bernard and Jeff Roberts story produced these for the stage. Music by Gordon Bash, Alex Burke, Adam Smith, The Angel, Zoe Rose Palladino, and Snake, Snake, Snakes. Additional thanks to all the dedicated Mortified live producers whose work make the stage show possible. Until next time, we remind you that we are freaks, we are fragile, and we all survive.